Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On today's show, we bring you a very special report from the 6th annual Beirut Design Week, which wrapped up on the 26th of May. First up,
we are not here to sell design, but we are here to develop the design scene of the country and to show the rest of the world what we are capable of doing.
The event's founder tells us about its growth and mission. Next,
people were using local craft in a contemporary way, was a way of being attached to their identity and the products that they are living with.
We talked to the design doyen credited with opening the city's mind to contemporary design. We also head to a former factory to see how designers are already working to meet the needs of the future. Plus, we visit a space for escaping the noise of the city. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, with the stated aim of prompting discussion around the capacity for design rather than simply flogging expensive furniture, Beirut Design Week is a more subtle and cerebral affair than many of the events in the design calendar. Who better then to guide us than journalist, design critic and former Monocle parishioner Hugo MacDonald, who brings us this special report.
Beirut Design Week is in its sixth year, a relative youngster on the ever-expanding Design Week circuit. But with youth comes ambition, and Beirut is certainly one of the more ambitious design events. In place of the more commercial agendas frequently adopted by other design weeks, there's an impetus here to engage in the bigger issues that design can impact. The mission is to address social, political, environmental, and technological issues by hosting a platform for discussion and education around the theme and question, is design a need? The event is masterminded by Doreen Tatukian, and I sat down with her to find out more.
I mean, it was definitely a rocky start in the beginning, and we were a very, very small organization with a team of barely two people. And then now, over the course of the last few years, we have a much bigger team and a much bigger audience. What this has also allowed us to do over time is to kind of have people know more about the event and kind of trust it more and have participants actually really engage with the theme that we give them. And we've also had a lot of freedom also to do the kind of stuff that we want to do that we were probably not so much capable of doing before, to kind of be a little bit more daring, a little bit more provocative, and to kind of like put questions like, is design a need as a theme, sort of in a kind of way that people were just a little bit confused in the beginning. And these are things that we were not capable of doing in the beginning because we kind of had to follow something of a structure that people would expect of a design week.
It's interesting, that point, particularly when I told people that I was coming to Beirut Design Week, a lot of people's responses were, how lovely to discover Lebanese craft. Mm-hmm. And obviously the impetus that you have is way above and beyond that. Mm-hmm. And it's a much more critical ideas-based event. And the programming that has gone into it has been really impressive, and all based around this idea of, is design a need? Mm-hmm. Where did the idea come from to make it much more about critical theory and less about commerce?
Mm-hmm. Well, we realized since we started the Design Week here, and I mean, this was in 2012, and there wasn't much going on in terms of design. There were a few names that you heard here and there, and these were all still very much within the whole luxury commercial aspect of design. But I, as a designer who have studied design research and design for social impact, knowing that there are a lot of other designers that can give a lot more, I also started to realize that all of these different types of events were kind of really confusing the audience towards a direction where they can think only of design for luxury, where design is a much broader thing. And I thought us as a Design Week, we should be probably the most self-critical, you know, compared to everything else. We are not here to sell design, but we are here to develop the design scene of the country and to show the rest of the world what we are capable of doing. I also was very adamant to show that there is definitely an intellectual side to design, you know, a really thinking side to it. And it's not just an end product that people want to put in their homes or to wear. So from there on, we got into the theme.
Just picking up on the point that you made just then, do you think then your approach about having an ideas-based design week feeds back into the design community here to make them more aware of design as an ideas-based discipline and less as a commercial industry?
I think that the commercial industry will always be there. it's always going to be part of design. You cannot completely alienate it at all. And at the same time, us, when we are focusing as a nonprofit organization on education, social impact, and entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurship part is definitely alive. We are definitely supporting a lot of young designers. We're giving them a lot of promotion, and they are really setting themselves apart from maybe designers in the region or even in the country, and they're capable after Design Week to go abroad and to market themselves everywhere else. So this already has existed, and it's almost easier in a way. Whereas if you want to get people to come to a Design Week and to think and to attend a conference and to engage with a theme that makes them question themselves is the harder challenge. And of course, we don't really have to do it, and maybe it's probably many people would say you're better off not doing it. But for us as a small organization who really cares about what's going on here, we think it's super important to take the challenge ourselves, and even if it might fail or even if it might not receive the most positive views, at least it makes people think. And that's the most important thing for us. I mean, if we're talking about education being one of our pillars, if we've got some impact definitely out there over the last 6 years because of all the people engaging with Design Week, and we definitely have the commercial and entrepreneurial side, I think that being critical is definitely the core of what is needed for us to develop the design education part of what we do.
How relevant is it that your Design Week has a theme like Is Design a Need, and it's rooted here in Beirut in Lebanon, rather than just being a global question for a global industry?
Of course it is contextual, and it should be. Definitely, when you're asking such a question and we're going more critical, it says a lot also on a variety of perspectives. So one is, we're not really going to focus too much on having some sort of a design fair or the luxury commercial side of things, because we have to also take into consideration that this is Lebanon, that we are in a state of really constant political insecurity, and we are surrounded by lots of countries and lots of political situations that really don't make it very easy for us to just be all, you know, let's have everybody come here and then do like something that happens in Milan. Mm. So I think that for us to be real and realistic about it, it is very important that we say, hey, this is still Beirut. Yes, it is design, but definitely we have to have another face. We cannot pretend to be like some European metropolitan city. Mm. And I think this is also what makes us special, you know? So the relevance of this being critical and is design a need also opens up the subject of, okay, so if design is not something that's only there to bring in these people to buy your stuff, what else can design do for a country that is really suffering from a lot of people that are not thinking critically in terms of their politics, and from a country that might be a little bit not as forward thinking in terms of design education, but really plans to and wishes to and has a lot of potential? I mean, you need to start the conversation somewhere, and this is why conversations for me at least start with a question.
Very good point. And to that very big question, maybe to end, is design a need?
Well, I said from the very beginning, I really did not want to answer that question, because the idea is that it really depends on what design means to each person. What design means to me is very different from what design means to a furniture designer, for example. I have been trained in a way to think of design as a sort of problem-finding, problem-solving type of tool. So I look at situations and I research them and I get insight from doing different things that make me have more information about the actual problem. And then from then on, come up with solutions. And of course, there's some point, some aesthetics involved, but really for me, that's a very small part of it. And from that sense and from that definition of design, yes, of course, it is a need. It's a very natural way of problem solving in a creative manner, especially in a country where there aren't really existing infrastructures that are going to help you solve the problem by the way it is.
That was Doreen Tutikian, director of Beirut Design Week there. Though still young, Beirut has an established homegrown design community. If you mention design to anyone in the city, they'll point you to Nada Debs. Nada is credited with opening up the city to the idea of contemporary design, combining traditional local craft elements with a modern sensibility. Her furniture graces homes, embassies, and government buildings across the region, and Nada is considered the doyenne of the Lebanese community. I sat down with her in her Jamaisi studio to find out more.
Although I'm Lebanese, I grew up in Japan. I studied in the United States at the Rhode Island School of Design, and I moved to London to start my first design work. 12 years ago, I moved to Beirut, and I founded my showroom and my studio. And my design approach is to take local craft And I tried to make it relevant to reach the contemporary design scene.
So how do you see the design scene here as having developed over the last 10 years?
When there was war going on, a lot of people left the country. When the war was over, they came back, and it was clear that they were looking for something that had an identity and that they can relate to, but at the same time, to be contemporary and in par with what's happening in the rest of the world. So I think that the fact that people were using local craft in a contemporary way was a way of being attached to their identity and the products that they are living with.
And how important is something like Beirut Design Week for the design community here, do you feel?
I think Beirut Design Week is a great platform because it's giving the young designers an opportunity to reach out to the world. What I find is that it's an opportunity to question design, and eventually I believe that there's going to be something called Lebanese design.
And do you feel that it's important when it's building an identity such as Lebanese design to open up to the rest of the world and have the rest of the world come and contribute to that conversation?
I think we have a lot of potential because we're actually in the middle of the West and the East. And so we have to really dig into who we are. And I think we're getting there.
That was Nada Debs, one of Beirut's best-loved designers, talking to me there. Now, the main event of Beirut Design Week was at KED, a former metallurgy factory in the Carantina area that was once a quarantine zone for refugees. Over three floors, a series of ideas were explored around the week's theme, Is Design a Need? One of the most thought-provoking showcases was an exhibition called Speculative Needs by MENA Design Research Centre. They collaborated with students from several Lebanese universities to imagine solutions to various social issues we'll face in our near future. I sat down with the project's curator, Tatiana Tutukian, to find out more.
So we've created this workshop that we took to nine different universities from the tip of the Lebanon to the southernmost part. And what we did was we developed a new methodology and a new fiction process in order to introduce students to what speculative and critical design is, and through that try to explore some different topics related to technology and sort of these noir, unspoken rooms of design, and to try to bring them out in like a funny, humoristic way that is like close to people so that they would be able to engage with it.
And you're tackling some very big universal issues here, which feel very relevant for the theme of the week. Is design a need? Could you tell us about one or two of the projects or one or two of the responses from the students that you've been working with?
So, is design a need is a critical question in itself. It's trying to discuss like what design is and like what is the role of design. So, one of the projects is called The Beauty Currency, and it's saying like designers are creating things like Instagram and YouTube and people are making money off of those. So looks are becoming, and beauty is becoming the new currency. So what if it's in a scenario where you're at a restaurant, let's say, and two people order the same meal, and there's this device that looks a lot like a mirror, and then they put it on your face, it looks like a perfect specimen, and it gives you a number, and based on this number, you start to pay your meal. So
it sounds terrifying, but it's probably not an inconceivable future.
I guess not, because, I mean, it's the reality now. And, you know, it's a snowball effect. Things get pushed quite easily in these days, especially with, like, technology and its evolution.
Horrifying. What about the grim-sounding flesh coin?
Flesh coin is about how we're evolving prosthetics. And now people are becoming half man, half machine, and these prosthetics are becoming lighter and more efficient. And so we would see that in the future, probably most of the people are going to be cyborgs rather than human. And this project is looking at, what if the majority of people are cyborgs? Then the desire to have more human kind of like elements would be the thing that is sought after. So this machine is put on the wall, and basically if you don't have any money, it's kind of like an ATM. You just put your hand on it and it gives you how much your hand is worth or how much like your body is worth.
My goodness, again, slightly scary future that is all too real for many of us. I'm also interested by the notion of DNA weddings.
That one is quite funny. The technology has led us to engineer even our own children. Like, you can pick what color eyes like a baby you want to have can have. And so this one is looking into a scenario where, let's say you're at a wedding, instead of giving somebody a couch, you would try to find the aspect that you like the most about you genetically, whether it's like your hair color, your eye color. Maybe you have a bloodline of, you know, people that are extremely funny. So that's what you would offer in this device. You would just put it on the slab and it would just analyze it, and you can just recreate your child after that.
Tell me, with Beirut Design Week itself, is there a legacy to it? It seems like it's opening up a lot of discussions and showcasing a lot of very interesting work. Is it more for the local community, or is it for the global design community, really, to sort of discover and think about these new ideas in a wider context?
In my opinion, I think like the local community is in dire need of having the conversations open up. So I think in first response, it would be for the locals. And somehow we tend to look at the internationals in order to get some inspiration, but then we develop our own things for the local. We curate it and we cater it so that we would be able to respond to the different situations that we are facing. And so maybe this project, like the speculative needs, is more global issues, but with the progression of the project, we might look at the different crises and be critical about that. How do we look at, let's say, the societal etiquette between people here, or how like there's like surveillance, or like the minority crisis, refugee crisis, the trash crisis, and we see how we can speculate and do projects based on that so we can change and alter mentalities and provoke. So I think Design Week is a great place to explore, and yeah, it's a great place to do things that can like kickstart in the region.
That was Tatiana Tutikian, curator of the Speculative Needs exhibition at Beirut Design Week. The only thing to block out the sound of construction across Beirut is the noise of the traffic. In the middle of a terrifying network of highways, in a dusty parking lot, the designer and scenographer Natalie Harb has opened a striking two-storey pink wooden pavilion. It's called the Silent Room, and her idea is to provide a place of sensory respite amidst the chaos of Beirut's urban onslaught. As much a place to escape the noise, though, Natalie's intention is a response to the more hypothetical din we all suffer from in modern life too. I spoke to Natalie to find out what it's all about.
I'm Natalie Harb. I'm a scenographer and installation artist. I live between London and Beirut. We're here in the Silent Room. That's a project I've been working on for a few months in collaboration with a group of architects called Booth, acoustic consultants called 21DB, and a sound designer, Khalid Yassin. And the project is like a small pavilion that we wanted to implement in an urban environment, an urban noisy environment. This is why we're very close to the highway and in between two neighborhoods. So it's this pink wooden structure inspired by tree houses. So there is a level where you kind of climb up and raise yourself from ground level. And there is a space in between, which is a passage. I mean, the whole space is created like a small public space that goes into a private one. And we've chosen it to be pink because it's a soothing color. It has the color of the skin, I think. I mean, it's the closest to skin. But also it's kind of festive, as opposite to colors usually associated with silence, which would be associated with solitude and something negative about it. So it's a bit more grim. So we wanted something quite colorful and present in the city.
The Silent Room is fairly self-explanatory in that it is a room to be quiet in a noisy urban environment. But actually there's a lot more thinking that's gone into it, and it's a symbolic experience as much as a literal one, isn't it?
Well, yeah, there are lots of layers of motivation to do that Silent Room. One of them is quite simple. The consumption society generates so much noise, whether auditive or visual, that it even managed to make of silence a luxury product that is only available for those who can afford it. So the idea was to restitute that by creating a public silent room. because one of the things that I didn't say before is that you come up and you get to a room which is acoustically isolated, all upholstered, like a cocoon. So that's one thing. It's to basically restitute a sense of balance in urban society. And then there is also the motivation to escape fear that is generated by information, by governments. Having grown up in war, basically one of the first spaces I became aware of is the shelter. And recently, in the last few years, I had the same feeling of fear to another degree, but a similar sense of fear that I basically experienced also traveling in other cities, of being threatened. And I think, you know, the world is going more radicalized and generating fear, which is not always real. You kind of wonder if it's real or not, if it's not narrative that you're supposed to believe, for governments to, you know, just do whatever they want, you know, have people who are scared and then they can justify all of their actions. And I've thought, well, if war has changed, its weapons have changed, the weapons being information, then the shelter changes consequently, and it becomes a space where you subtract yourself willingly from information.
It's a fascinating idea and almost vital, actually, in terms of how we deal with modern life and all of the pressures that we face on a daily basis. Trying to carve out space for oneself in that is increasingly difficult. This is a prototype here,
yes,
essentially, but is the idea that it could actually become something that is embedded into life in a more permanent way?
Well, that's the idea. This is what we tried doing here. Basically, we created the version 01 to see how that would work. How would people react to it if they really need it? If it's not just an idea in our head. And basically, the response to it was great. Basically, now we're looking after this on how we can implement it in city, have it in different neighborhoods, just as simply and in an utilitarian way as public toilets, basically, because, you know, like, silence has become a basic need that is not available. So yeah, that's the step after that project being here.
And that was Natalie Harb at the Silent Room speaking to Hugo MacDonald. And I'm glad to say that Hugo is still here in studio. We've heard some amazing voices. We've heard about an interesting new feature on the design horizon, maybe a more critical, a bit more of a thoughtful one. Tell me what your take-homes were from doing it and seeing it, a lively, interesting city. Are we going to see you there more than we're going to see you in Milan?
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you mentioned Milan there, because I think as the dust has settled from the Salone del Mobile, common feeling amongst the design community is that it was very hollow this year, and it really did fail to engage in the bigger issues that are facing us across life, across the world even. And here you have a very young design week by comparison that is really doing its best to try and grapple with these big things. And not just in a heroic attempt, but actually with some very interesting voices, interesting younger voices who I'm sure we're going to see a lot more of in the future.
And tell me, do you think the commercial pressures of hosting a huge show, of fashion brands trying to cash in on it, doing collaborations, has diluted some of the thoughtfulness of Salone? And, you know, if so, is it not such an insurmountable beast? Is it easier to get people's attention because, you know, you can do these interesting individual things?
Definitely. It is one of the benefits of youth that you can be ambitious, and perhaps there are lower expectations, so you really can try things in a way that at Salone it's so heavy and there is such huge commercial expectation that runs throughout the week. But I think that the two can coexist quite happily. Speaking to Doreen, she's very keen that Beirut holds on to its very challenging position within the design community, and that it doesn't go down the obvious way of getting massive commercial sponsors just to be able to host bigger events, that it stays young and light and dynamic and challenging.
And our very special thanks to design journalist and critic Hugo MacDonald for that special report on this year's Beirut Design Week. Sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, Henry Rees Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to bother Henry at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. Do also check out our weekly sister show On Design, where we devote a few minutes each week to delving deeper into the history or future of an idea, place, or person changing the design industry today. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.